it's been.
Great presentation. We really recognize, and there are many questions. One of them is, how do you give faculty credit? I think most of you have passed tenure, but how do you arrange that?
So the question is, how do we give faculty credit? And basically, we don't on a measurable way. We try to reduce the amount of the workload for faculty mentors by running all the students through a single faculty member in terms of organization. There is, on paper, the idea that you get release time if you have 20 students over a period of time. So it's a cumulative. Once you get to 20, you're supposed to get a reduction in course load. That's not happened in my experience, but it's on paper as a possibility. So that's our biggest struggle. Faculty generally enjoy the experience, and so most people are willing to take it out of Hyde a little bit. But that's one of the biggest impediments.
But it does lead to more, maybe it leads to more publications.
It certainly does, especially if you string together a series of undergraduate projects. You can basically have a master's student, and so you can get publications, maybe preliminary data for grant proposals. And from that standpoint, it's very valuable.
Do you have a number of so many students, there have been so many peer-reviewed journal articles accepted?
We do have those data. At least from my experience since 99, we've had 12 peer-reviewed articles accepted. So, other questions? Yes, sir.
At the end, you said that the students do presentations and posters. Do they get training as part of the coursework and how to do that?
Yes. The question was, the students doing posters and presentations, do they get training? They do in that tools course as sophomores, and then in the scientific writing course as juniors. And then they get individual help with faculty members for seniors. One last question. So the question is, how do the students choose the research they're interested in, and how do they get assigned to faculty members? Right now, in our tools class, they get introduced to the research that's being done in the department, and then as part of their scientific communication, they visit with faculty members, see which projects are available, and if they're willing to mentor the students. So we try to have it as a interplay between student desires and faculty time, and both have to agree to do the project.
I'm going to talk to you today about Vidalia beetle, Rhodiola cardinalis. And most of you know this one really well because it's sort of parented the biological control program in University of California, certainly, as well as nationwide. The pest cottony cushion scale arrived in the late 1800s, and Vidalia beetle was brought in, and it did a very fine job of controlling this pest and saving the citrus industry in California. I work in the central San Joaquin Valley, shown in the center of the California photograph there. And so most of the comments I make today about citrus will be with respect to that particular region. Cottony cushion scale damage has two problems. One is they produce a huge amount of honeydew, which creates sooty mold, which then rains down onto the fruit. That can be washed off in harvest. The most serious aspect of cottony cushion scale is that when the densities are high, the trees actually stop producing very much fruit, and so it has a direct impact on yield. So that's why the cottony cushion scale, or the Vidalia beetle, has been so important in reducing those pest populations. Now, in the San Joaquin Valley of California, for decades, the conventional program for controlling all of the major pests, which include various lepidopteran, citrus thrips, red scale, were organophosphates and carbamates for many, many years, 40 plus years. And gradually, the two key pests, thrips and scale, red scale, developed resistance to those particular products, and that's shown in red. And so in the recent period of time, since the early 90s, a whole slew of new insecticides have become registered in an attempt to replace those organophosphates and carbamates. For example, for citrus thrips control, there's spinosad known as Success, sabadillo, which is a botanical known as Veratran, abamectin, which is Agromec. For California red scale, the majority of treatments have shifted over to the chemical piroxifen, which is an insect growth regulator. And in addition, we had other situations sort of come about as that organophosphate and carbamate use declined, and it did quite dramatically when we got the piroxifen for scale and the spinosad for thrips, over 75% reduction in the amount of pounds used AI in the San Joaquin Valley. Two pests appeared as problems. They went from secondary to primary. The first one is citricola scale. Pesticides weren't needed for it in the past because it was very sensitive to organophosphates and carbamates, and so it was kept under control by the treatments for thrips and red scale. So growers have been gradually reintroducing organophosphates for that particular pest, and also as well as that, to a certain extent, the neonicotinoids, imidacloprid and acetamiprid, also work on citricola scale, and so that they've been introduced for that particular pest. Katydid, similar story, very susceptible to low rates of organophosphates, didn't even exist as a pest, particularly until growers stopped using those compounds. And now grower response to katydid problems are to introduce low rates of chlorpyrifos or pyrethroids or use difluobenzuron. So we've had this huge shift from an organophosphate carbamate supported system to a whole slew of new insecticides. And one of my jobs was to try and determine, okay, what impact are these particular pesticides going to have on the Vidalia beetle in the citrus system? And just to show you a little bit of details about pesticide use patterns and how big those shifts are, you can see the red and the blue, which are the organophosphates and the carbamates, just really collapsed in the early 2000s. And were replaced primarily with spinosad, which is the green. And then you see an increase in the black bars, which are pyrethroids, and the yellow. And some of the organophosphate and carbamate use started coming back. And my premise is that the katydids, those chemicals were being used for katydid control. And what the growers do is they tank mix the spinosad with these other materials for katydids so that they only have one application cost. So we're seeing an increase in some of the more broad-spectrum pesticides. And for scale, similar kind of pattern. When the piroxifen, the most dominant replacement for OPs, came into use in the late 1990s, OP use came down quite dramatically. But in recent years, it's increased again, and I think that's because of the citricola scale problem. Okay, so we ran a series of experiments to look at the effects on adult survival for 72-hour exposure, the progeny they produce, and then taking second instar larval stages and following them through their full development to see what effect pesticides had on these, on Vidalia beetle. And the way we did this was we grew cotton and cushion scale and pittosporum, and then we would treat the pittosporum and then provide food during this 72-hour period to the adults and larvae of treated plant material with treated cottony cushion scale, and we also provided some untreated cottony cushion scale. So it was sort of the worst case scenario. What if they were on treated plants and the pest had also been treated with the chemical? Let's look at some of the responses. This is the percentage survival of adults over a 72-hour period, and basically, the only chemicals that really cause serious problems with adults are the fairly broad-spectrum pyrethroids and some of the foliar neonicotinoids. Notice that superside, the animal could just walk through superside treatments, which is one of our more toxic organophosphates, and that is just documentation that over 45 years of exposure created quite resistant Vidalia beetles. And so OPs can be used in the citrus system in an IPM sense to reduce another pest that and then allows Vidalia beetle to survive and continue to control cottony cushion scale. So adults are not heavily affected with the exception of pyrethroids, and generally the residues at the top, I have different columns where we took different periods of residuality, so 6 weeks after treatment, 2 months after treatment, run the experiment and see what happens. And you can see that, for the most part, they survive pretty well after a month or two of the residues breaking down. Here's the number of progeny per female over a 72-hour exposure to these chemicals. I would say most chemicals cause some reduction in the amount of eggs laid or eggs that hatch, but the two groups of chemicals that caused the most problem were the piriproxifen or esteem, which the effect lasted pretty significantly over a 4-month period, and the pyrethroids, which lasted over 5 months in terms of reducing progeny. So we've not only are killing some of the adults, we're definitely, with these new chemical groups, some of them significantly reducing the amount of progeny that develop from the eggs. Okay, now let's look at larvae, which are put on pesticide residues and then followed through their entire lifespan. The green lines are cyfluthrin and fenpropithrin, which are both pyrethroids, and you notice they get a very quick kill within a day after the animals are placed on there. There's very high mortality. Then the next group of bars, the blue ones, acetamiprid and imidacloprid, are neonicotinoids. It takes a little longer. They're just a little slower acting. It takes more like a week to kill the larvae. Then we move on to spinosad, which was relatively harmless to the animal, and abamectin. And then the final one on this graph is piriproxifen, which is the insect growth regulator. It is a juvenile hormone mimic, and so it does not really affect the animals until they try and pupate, and then it just nails them. Here's a similar experiment with piriproxifen included in here as sort of a standard. You can see that, again, the imidacloprid and thiamethoxam are neonicotinoids. Even as a drench, something applied to the soil that never touched the leaves or the prey, it's taken up into the plant, taken up into the prey, and when fed to these larvae, caused very high mortality. So we need to be careful with some of these neonicotinoids that we claim they're selective by their nature of being applied as a systemic. They're really not. The animal is, Vidalia larvae are getting toxic quantities of them through feeding on poisoned prey. So the imidacloprid was much more strong in its effect than the thiamethoxam. And then we have bupropion, which is a chitin synthesis inhibitor, and it didn't affect them until they tried to molt. And then, again, there was very high mortality and virtually no mortality from the methidothione, the organophosphate. And then if we look over periods of time, how long does this effect last? Well, abamectin and spinosad, their effects are short-term, at most less than a month. The neonicotinoids in blue are sort of intermediate. They last for a month or two. But the pyrethroids and the insect growth regulator, piriproxifen, are quite toxic and last for many, many months in terms of the residual effect impact on the larvae. And this is just another experiment with another group of pesticides, but the same point here that we've got sort of grades of mortality where the neonicotinoids break down fairly quickly. The soil applied, that's what the S stands for. The systemic lasts longer than the foliar, but the most toxic chemicals we found in all our tests were the IGR piriproxifen, to a lesser extent the bupropion, and then the pyrethroids were quite toxic. During 1998, as growers shifted from organophosphates to piriproxifen for control of California red scale, nearly 50,000 acres of citrus were treated with piriproxifen, and Vidalia beetle disappeared for 9 months. I thought I was going to have to go back to Australia and go find it again and bring it back over, because it just vanished valley-wide. And we had enormous cottony cushion scale outbreaks. And I, talking to old-timers, this similar situation happened in the 1970s when Carzol, a carbamate, was introduced. So severe disruption. Vidalia beetle did come in the next year, and it grew to enormous numbers. And the picture on your right is Vidalia pupae encrusting a Satsuma mandarin trunk. So it shows that they have an incredible power of increase, and they did come back really well. So what I've done from a management standpoint is talk to growers about how cottony cushions.